Our gospel lesson is Jesus with his disciples and encountering the rules and the regulations of his day, coming to us from the second chapter of the Gospel of Mark. Let us listen for God's word speaking to us. One Sabbath day, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and as Jesus and his disciples made their way, his disciples began to pluck the heads of grain. The Pharisees said to Jesus, "Look, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" And he said to them, "Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need of food? He entered the house of God where Abiathar was high priest and ate the bread of the presence, which it is not lawful for any but the priests to eat. And he gave some to his companions." Then Jesus said to them, "The Sabbath was made for humankind, and not humankind for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath." Again, Jesus entered the synagogue, and a man was there with a withered hand. They watched to see whether he would cure him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man with the withered hand, "Come forward." Then he said to them, "Is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save life or to kill?" But they were silent. Jesus looked around at them with anger. He was grieved at their hardness of heart and said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him how to destroy Jesus. May God bless to us this reading, for this is the gospel of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You know, thinking about this Sunday, after all the whirlwind of activity and energy and, yes, a little bit of stress for the Strawberry Festival, and also with this roller coaster weather we're having, where is summer? I imagine you're probably not in the mood for a long-winded dissertation about the ins and outs of scriptural texts this morning. But I do think that there's an important theme in the text today which can be very helpful to us, not just today, but throughout the summertime of travel, of rest, of reflection, and rejuvenation that is hopefully upon us. We need these times to regroup. We need these times to think about our lives, and perhaps these scriptures are some that we can take with us to ponder in that. So what is the tying bond between the texts for today? Or another way of putting it, what does God see in us? Well, let's talk about image. Let's talk about reputation and status and PR in the Bible. You know, I remember when I learned about one of the great pieces of Bible trivia. In one of the churches that I was serving, the very first pastor, and this was almost three centuries ago, had a biblical name that was perfect for trivia. And, well, let's see. Let's see if anybody knows who this person was. If they do, it could be the end of the sermon. Who was Eliab? I've seen a lot of blank faces. The name that appears only once in the Bible, Eliab. Well, the first pastor of this church, his first name was Eliab, Eliab Byram. All right, well, you see, this piece of trivia has to do with the prophet Samuel, who was searching for a new Messiah, a new anointed one who would then succeed King Saul to be the king of Israel. And so he goes, as he's instructed by God, to see a man named Jesse who had a whole bunch of sons. And the first son, the eldest son, who was very big and strong and impressive, was named Eliab. There you go. Okay, the oldest son of Jesse was named Eliab. And you think, surely this must be the one. He's big, he's impressive, he's the oldest. And God says, nah. And so then he goes through the next son. Because you see, Samuel had fallen into the trap of thinking, like Israel, that if someone really looks the part, like Saul, then that must be the one to lead. But God says no, and so he goes to the next son, no, next son, no, until he goes all the way down and he turns to Jesse and says, do you have any other sons? And he says, well, there's this scrawny little David. He's out there watching the sheep. And so Samuel goes to see him, and God says, oh, yeah. And so he anoints him. This is the one. You see, they saw a scrawny little boy out there watching the sheep. God saw a king. Paul the Apostle, as Joyce read to us, he had a problem with PR as well, with his appearance, with his demeanor. Having established all of these churches throughout the Mediterranean, Paul now found, to his chagrin, that others were teaching and preaching and leading, and they were perceived as dynamic speakers and suave personalities and powerful presences. And Paul even sarcastically refers to them as the super apostles. Sounds like a new show on cable. Probably will be a new show on cable. But Paul then reminds, as we heard, he reminds his churches that the strength of God is most displayed in loving forgiveness and sacrifice of self. By Jesus Christ dying on the cross at the hands of the powerful and the self-righteous. Paul reminds him, God sees strength in weakness, not in the beauty or the eloquence or personality of what the world upholds as admirable and desirable. God rather sees the inner self. And of course, in the gospel, Jesus has his disciples picking grain on the Sabbath. He heals a leper on the Sabbath. And both of these are technically violations of the Sabbath regulations in the Hebrew religious laws. Is the main point here the personal insensitivity of the religious ones who complain? No, the main point is who Jesus is. The main point is how his influence transforms situations from those of playing the system for self-advantage into situations of just letting the inner person God sees respond to God in acts and in ways of goodness and love and grace. It is God's insight into us that defines the Sabbath and all of life, not our insight into God. It's how God knows us. It is what honors God the most that makes life good, not chasing the illusion of some ideal good life. There are plenty of examples from stories and media, but you may remember from some time back the movie Wall Street. Remember that? Michael Douglas was playing the ruthless financier Gordon Gekko. He's built up this empire of hostile takeovers and leveraged buyouts, some of them bending the SEC rules, some of them breaking the SEC rules. And Charlie Sheen plays this young blue-collar man, Bud Fox, who envisions fulfillment for himself residing the gecko way of life. He gets caught up in all the excitement of the hunt, and he soon becomes a right-hand man for Gordon Gekko. And his meteoric rise leaves a trail of hurt and bewildered relationships as he strives after what, for him, he thought was the pearl of great price, the power, the prestige, the wealth. Of course, the movie reaches a critical mass, and it becomes clear to Bud Fox that Gekko intends to take over and dismantle a company which Bud's father has worked for his whole life, because he's used Bud Fox as an inroad to gain support from the union for a takeover bid. That's something that Bud's father had even warned him about. And when reality momentarily wins over blind ambition, he sees what is happening. He saw his father's life about to be jerked out from under him, and suddenly his meteoric rise feels like the sinking to the absolute depths. And he pulled himself together and made decisions about what was now really important in life. He orchestrated the demise of the deal, which led to his own arrest for illegal trading, but it preserved the company and the values for which his father had worked a lifetime. So the man, Bud Fox, who walks away toward a police car in handcuffs, is more fulfilled than the man, Bud Fox, riding the wave of success in the world's eyes. And in the end, fulfillment's a matter of the heart, letting what's inside choose what is good in life over the idol of the good life. Is making such a choice really a sacrifice? Well, actually, I don't think that many people are drawn to actions that don't benefit them. And that applies to Christianity too. You might question that one. You mean, look at Jesus. After all, after his meteoric success, at first he was crucified. And all those people since who have been killed or persecuted for their faith, is it to their benefit? Is this a great as your reward in heaven thing? No. In real time, in real daily life, faith is always a matter of deciding between what is the good life, the momentary benefit, and what is life that is good in God's eyes. I may have mentioned to you at some time of a friend who's been a longtime friend named David Masoma. David was a black South African Presbyterian pastor who counseled students in nonviolent responses to apartheid during the 1970s and 80s. And David had to flee in the mid-1980s, flee apartheid and arrest to America, and he was accepted at Princeton Seminary. And that's where David and I met and became friends. He was 5 years later, he received his PhD from Princeton, and he was invited back to South Africa for an interview at the University of South Africa, no one knowing, including him, whether it was simply a trick to get him back to be arrested, maybe never heard from. But it was real, a real offer, a real interview, and he was chosen for this position. Now, to be honest, being here, fleeing from apartheid, getting a PhD from Princeton, he probably could have found a cushy job in any theology department in America in pursuit of the good life, away from dangers and pressures and uncertainties in South Africa. But knowing David, there really wasn't a decision to make, because he knew the strength God had given him in the weakness of his social position in South Africa, a strength of hope and faith. And so David returned to South Africa because of a life that is good, instead of simply seeking the good life. And since those times, since 1990, when he went back, he has made a huge difference in South Africa as a leader and an inspirational example, particularly during the time of the dismantlement of apartheid and the presidency of Nelson Mandela. And today, David is far and wide known and respected for his honesty and his courage and his faith in those changing and complex times. In every society, in every neighborhood, in every life, we're confronted constantly by pressures to pursue life for the appearance of big and impressive, of magnetic and alluring, of pietistic and self-righteous. Because this leads, according to what our culture admires and desires and emulates, to the good life. But in a society of community, an individual, if they simply pursue elevation of self without choosing self-giving for the sake of others, without love that finds fulfillment in the advancement of others, without healing care that goes against the grain of the status quo, how can that society, community, individual call that very life good? Now, I know not every person can be a David Masoma, or somebody like a Mother Teresa in Calcutta, or, as I've lifted before us before, Reverend Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers. But wait a minute, maybe we are capable of being that. We each have so many challenges and changes and opportunities to pursue a life that is good, because we know and we dwell in a God who makes life good. And we seek to let God's Spirit dwell in us every single day. It doesn't really take doing miracles to let God make a miracle out of us. We just need to choose life that is filled with good. It may not be flashy or granted notoriety. It might not even seem worthy of our talents to others, but it's not others who see the inside of our hearts, is it? We're sharing our Bible study this morning, as Barry was sharing with us, that once he'd had a trucker, when his car broke down, simply attach a chain to his front bumper and pull him to a gas station, not knowing what was going to happen. And it turned out it was somebody just doing a good Samaritan act. And yet it wasn't just that one act, because it's something that tempered and colored his life in the way he chose to treat others. And so the miracle is sometimes one that keeps repeating itself, isn't it? What does God see in us? God sees the potential to choose between the good life and life that is truly good as the chief direction of who we are. What's the plan? How do we do this? Of course, it's different from every person. For some have the opportunity to do major things and others to do numerous smaller things. But at the heart of it, it seems to be a matter of being the person who's at peace in a relationship with God. And by extension, at peace with others. And even more, by extension, at peace with ourselves. That's the goal. And based on that goal, we can decide what course then we choose to follow for each one of us. I once heard an interesting comment. Somebody wrote that they never heard someone near the end of their years looking back and saying, "Looking back, I wish I had spent more time at my desk." Have you ever heard anybody say that? I know I won't. But the comment's made in jest, but if you think about it, it's pretty profound. Sometimes it is helpful to project to the time when most of our earthly days lie behind us and wonder what we wish we might have done more of based on who we are and what we do now. My guess is that we would all wish that we had, in this present stage of life, given more time and energy to be close to those we care about, to fulfill ambitions that would make the world and our community a better place. That we would seek out ways to be more genuine as a person. That we would try to think more reflectively and more deeply about God, about spirit, about spirituality, and about ourselves in God's creation. I think we would wish that at the age we are now, that we would make decisions which would ultimately make life more satisfying than simply more pleasurable for the short term. So friends, what does God see in us? I deeply believe that God sees the Spirit of the living Christ within us. The real question we should ask, that God wants us to ask, is this: do we see the Spirit of the living Christ within ourselves? Do we? And if we do, and when we do, how will we share that with one another? And how will we fulfill what is good in life?